the week. And Admiral, if you'll allow, at the end of the operations report, we do have a couple of special topics we'd like to cover, including the status of our transition into the winter program. You'll notice on the first page of your report today that I have a page there with an office address and phone number for our Exxon office in Anchorage, where our winter office will be located. Some personnel have already started relocating there, and we thought that might be of general interest. On the next page is our operations summary data for the week. Beginning with safety, there were a total of 22 injuries for the week. No Exxon injuries, 21 lost time contractor injuries, and one medical treatment. And while, of course, we regret there were any injuries at all, our overall safety record continues to be considerably better than comparable industry in the construction industry. Looking at our major equipment summary, total vessels deployed of 786 in Prince William Sound, 333 in the Gulf of Alaska, a total of 1,119. That's down about 90 vessels versus last week. 29 skimmers, 57 aircraft, total boom deployed of 99,000 feet, another 216,000 feet available. Our shoreline progress for the week, 30.8 miles in Prince William Sound, 13.5 in Gulf of Alaska, for a total of 44.3. And that includes 2.7 for yesterday. Total miles of 1,084.5. 4.2 miles remain to be treated. 3.5 miles in Prince William Sound. 0.5 in the Gulf of Alaska. Landing craft total 51. 17 barges. 36 berthing vessels. Total personnel 9,176. That's down about 730 versus last week. Oil recovered 385 barrels for the week, and over 40,000 feet of boom cleaned during the week. Next, I'd like to cover the highlights of activities in Prince William Sound, then Gulf of Alaska. We'll begin with Prince William Sound. Bill Stillings and Wayne Voskamp will cover those highlights. While they're joining us, I will mention a few of the accomplishments for last week. As you know, weather did continue to deteriorate, although we did have a very nice day Sunday, one of the nicest days we've had in a long time. However, we did make progress, and as I said, 3.5 miles remain in the Sound. Yesterday, we did disperse vessels and make safety preparations in response to the tsunami warning following the earthquake. The preparations and then redeployment of the vessels were made without incident. We felt good about that. We felt even better that it was only a warning. We did receive Coast Guard approval on 27 shoreline segments last week. 9 of those required no treatment. Task Force 3 has been decommissioned during the week. Bioremediation, I've included several numbers in there on status. The most significant is that 52 miles in the Sound have been bioremediated at this point in time. And we did continue the Corexit test, and we'll have more to say about that as we get into the more detailed report. Wayne?
I'm Wayne Voskamp with Exxon. I'm coordinator for Task Forces 1, 2, and 6 in Prince William Sound. I'll cover the week's highlights in those task forces and then turn things over to Bill Stillings, who coordinates the other Prince William Sound task forces. Starting first with Task Force 1, which has continued to be assigned areas in the southern sector of the Sound. That task force was augmented with a small group out of Task Force 6 when it completed its work, as I mentioned last week. Task Force 6 had been assigned areas in the Shawnee Bay, Main Bay, Chenega Island, and the remaining sectors in Herring Bay. That did complete all of that work, and they're currently in the decommissioning phase. The areas that Task Force 1 is currently working includes, and all of these will be below and off the map toward the bottom, it includes three segments on the west side of Latouche Island, one segment on the northern tip of Elrington Island. They're also now working the northern part of Latouche Island, that being segment LA-15, as well as Sleepy Bay. And also I've begun to do some work in the southern portion of Montague Island around Hanning Bay. Moving next to Task Force 2, currently headquartered out of Snug Harbor. Task Force 2 has had a good week. They've cleared virtually all of the area assigned to that task force, which reaches as far south as Hogan Bay and a little bit beyond that. Work in Snug Harbor is complete, work in Marsha Bay is complete, and work including all of the area as circled on the map is complete, with the exception of one segment, segment Night 26, which is close to the Bay of Isles, and that task force will be getting to that segment as weather permits in the near term. That's a summary of those three task forces. I'll ask Bill Stillings to come up and discuss the remaining task forces of Prince William Sound.
Thanks, Wayne. My name is Bill Stillings, and I coordinate task forces, what used to be three, which is no longer, task forces four, which we have split at this time, and Task Force 5. As we mentioned last week, Task Force 3 completed the areas of Perry, Lone Island, and Colross Island and was demobilized during the week. And that effort is going along well at this time. Task Force 4, which was working the Eleanor Island and we'd moved it into the Upper and Lower Passage, was split during the week with the main part of the task force coming down into the lower section, berthing in Mummy Bay on the Coastal Star and moving the main part of the troops onto the Duluth for work in the Point Helen area, assisted by Task Force 2. The remaining part of Task Force 4 has stayed on the 312 and the Jan B and continued to do the final work in the Ingot Island, Disk Island area. They're working the final segment on night 211. They're then going to do some cleanup and bioremediation work in the Naked Island area. And then they have the one area over on the northern end of Montague Island that has yet to be done. Task Force 5 continues to work Smith Island. Due to the severe weather we've experienced over the last several weeks, we've moved the Resurrection Bay back around into Northwest Bay, and the task force is moored there, and they move out of the Northwest Bay area and come out to work Smith Island. The decreasing amount of good weather we've had, or the increase in bad weather, has caused delays in the work activity. It's very difficult to make that transit, and then the Smith Island being exposed has created operational problems during the last week. Smith Island is where the Corexit test is ongoing. We were able to run another section of the test on Sunday the 3rd on Smith Island 6. We feel the test was very successful. We had a good application on a small segment of shoreline in there. We felt recovery was very good and we're very pleased with the test overall. We have one more section of beach just to the east of the area where we worked on Sunday that is appropriate for Corexit use at that point, and we'll be doing that hopefully tomorrow with the weather improving that we saw this afternoon. Bioremediation is continuing with two teams working bioremediation. Predominantly the first team completed the Herring Bay application this last week, numerous other areas. The second team, working with the Don Bollinger, is moving up now toward Naked Island to do that work this coming week. Are there any questions I can answer?
I wonder, when we, if you do that, if that Corexit test comes off tomorrow, I'd like to ask that somebody take some samples of the plume. I'm still uncomfortable with what is in that plume, and I haven't seen any results that would indicate to me that we've had a good sampling of it. And I don't think that's a big problem. Just take a couple of bottles of it and bring it back. Let's find out what's in it.
Okay, I believe the plume has been sampled. We'll be happy to do it again, Admiral.
Well, maybe you have some analysis on it. I haven't seen it.
Okay. With the test on Sunday, we do feel that the plume was well contained within the primary. There was some slight transgression with the wave action out into the secondary boom, but we saw no sign of any plume outside the secondary. But certainly we'll be happy to sample.
I'd just like to know what's in it.
I believe, Admiral, that the plume was sampled, not by Exxon, but by agencies during prior tests. I saw no results higher than one part per million of oil and suspended in the water. And perhaps you might suggest who'd be the best, if you will, third party to sample again to make sure there are no disputes.
Well, I don't really care who does it. I'd like to see some of that stuff. We can do it. I can have the Coast Guard monitors do it, but just somebody to get a shot at it. I don't think there's anything in it that I'm concerned about, but I'd like to know what's in it.
All right. There have been no results that would indicate any reason for concern, and of course it wouldn't hurt to sample again and see if that's confirmed.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
To cover highlights for the Gulf of Alaska, Ron Polk, our coordinator for Gulf of Alaska, will cover those.
My name's Ronnie Polk. I handle the shoreline cleanup operations in the Gulf of Alaska, where we have headquarters in Homer, Seward, and Kodiak. We've made continue to make progress toward completing our planned work in the Gulf of Alaska. This past week, our total treated miles are 52. This includes the progress that Bill Rainey discussed earlier, plus we also retreated 38 miles of impacted shoreline that had been previously treated. During this past week, the Coast Guard approved demobilization on 121 miles, and this brings the total to 75% of the work that we've done so far. This reflects the paperwork that we've received, and in addition to this, they've also completed several other inspections where the paperwork is still in the process. Our total manpower on the shoreline is currently 292 OSRTs, and total manpower involved in the Gulf of Alaska is 1,152 people. We have 333 vessels in service and 49 aircraft operating in the Gulf of Alaska. Looking first at our Kodiak area down to the south, we have 167 OSRTs currently working in Kodiak. We're working in four locations. We're waiting on weather right now. Across the Shilikof Strait this week, we've been severely impacted by weather. We seem like we were able to work about one day, and then we have to wait on weather about three. So it's a fairly inefficient operation, but we are continuing to put safety top priority and protection of our people above everything else. And so we are following the weather. As soon as the weather improves, we'll be going back to treat those areas shown on the map there. Our Larson Bay village crew is about to complete their work at the one location there shown on Kodiak Island. We do still have some retreating going on in a few locations on Kodiak. This week, we have continued to catch up on our Coast Guard demobilization approval. The inspection teams are out and working hard, and total we have 476 miles approved through September 4th. This week we wrapped up our hot water washing operations on the north end of Kodiak Island, and that hot water washing team was demobilized. As far as near-term activities and issues, we're continuing to monitor the weather very closely. We receive weather reports forecast every 6 hours, and we're trying to keep all our teams well informed on the outlook for weather and where their locations that they're working in, so that they can make appropriate plans for evacuation of those areas in the event of severe weather. We continue to support the U.S. Coast Guard Segment demob efforts and that work is progressing well. We'll be continuing to complete our Type A treatment work using large seaworthy vessels. We're getting into a period of time now where most of the small vessels are completing the work season. It's safe to do this shoreline cleanup work in, and we will be completing the remaining work with larger vessels. We're continuing to make transition to our winter operations plan. In Homer, we currently have 39 OSRTs working with a very limited amount of work remaining to be done in that area. We're over 99% complete. We're working in three locations in Windy Bay and one in Fort Dick, as shown on the map there. We've had submitted four additional segments for approval. This week, we completed recleaning of Petroff Point. We completed log burning and additional Type A cleanup on Elizabeth Island. As far as near-term activities there, we're continuing with our hot water washing operations in Windy Bay and Chugach Bay with two LCVs and two teams, and that work will be finishing up here in the next few days. We're continuing to work with the Coast Guard on demobilization approvals, and this week we plan to submit the remaining requests for inspection to the Coast Guard. And we're also making transition there to our winter plan. In Seward, we currently have 86 OSRTs working on the shoreline. We're 99% complete. We're just finishing up hot water washing operations in several locations, and these crews are moving in, and we'll have one location working here tomorrow at Hoof Point. Will be the one location we're continuing to work on to complete there here within the next few days. Our accomplishments this week, we've completed log burning at Yellow Glacier Beach. We're continuing our Type A cleanup at Hoof Point. We've received approval from the Coast Guard to demobilize 23 segments. We've also completed, as I mentioned earlier, our hot water washing locations in Seward, and we're beginning to release these small vessels as this work is completed. And we'll, as I mentioned, in Kodiak, we'll be continuing to work off of our larger vessels to complete the remaining work there. Just the near term there was continuing to work Hoof Point and complete that work and continuing the transition to our winter program. I'd like to point out, respond to one item that was discussed in the ADEC's September 1st report regarding Tagetik Island, which is on the south end of Kodiak. The report suggested that throughout the summer, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, ADF&G, and ADEC had placed a high priority on treating this area because it is a sensitive bird rookery and seal haulout area, and suggested that we had deferred treatment of that until only recently. And I did want to point out that we did submit in late June our plans for moving in there and conducting the Type A treatment, and we had been requested by U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to defer that treatment until August 1st until to a period of time when there was a minimum residence. There would be a minimum number of these sensitive species in that area, and we did honor that request, and we did treat it in August, and so that I think that was in compliance with the request of those agencies. We summarize our operations in the Gulf of Alaska. I'd like to say I'm proud of our work group, and I think continue to face some tough challenges and facing the elements and the environment that they're working in out there, and they continue to be successful at completing the work that we have and doing that safely.
Have we finished the log burning? Is that the last beach for burning?
That's right.
We should be done now.
Yes, sir. Any other questions? Thank you.
Next, Rob Dragnick will cover our waste management and environmental report.
Good evening. I'm Rob Dragnick from the Waste Management Group. During the past week, we disposed of 1,300 tons of oily solid waste, bringing the total solid waste disposal to date of about 21,400 tons. And our offshore incinerators, with regard to the AET incinerator barge out at Kodiak Island, we completed installation of the new refractory lining in both the primary and the secondary combustion chambers this past week. AET secured ADEX concurrence and began curing the refractory lining last Sunday, September the 3rd. Process went smoothly and was completed this afternoon. Unit was cooled down and inspected, and it appears that the job was very successful. No problems anticipated there. At this point, the unit is now ready to begin waste incineration. On August the 31st, ADEC advised AET and Exxon that the AET permit was voided because it was improperly issued. ADEC advised that they had bypassed the Kodiak Island Borough's formal consistency determination as required by state regulation. ADEC advised the borough on 9-1, September the 1st, that it had 10 days in which to provide a conclusive consistency determination. Assuming the borough responds by September the 11th, within the 10-day period, we would not expect AET to receive a new permit until something in the September 12th to September 15th timeframe. We did request ADEC to expedite this process using authority provided under state regulation, but that request was denied. On September the 1st, we also received a copy of ADEC's August the 25th response to the Port Lions request for a stay of the permit and an adjudicatory hearing. ADEC denied the request for a stay, but granted the adjudicatory hearing. Although ADEC's current voiding of the permit seems to make the hearing unnecessary, we do intend to intervene if the proceeding continues. Exxon is, of course, extremely disappointed that the AET permit was voided. It was particularly disheartening to learn that after such a lengthy permitting process, the proper procedures were not followed. We had been earlier led to believe that ADEC felt that the amount of time necessary in permitting was to ensure that the permit would be properly processed and issued. The latest delay, of course, severely cuts into the remaining operating time for the incinerator and is forcing us to carefully review the alternatives. We're concerned that this delay may preclude the use of the incinerator for waste disposal this summer. On a brighter note, the Sealy incinerator did begin waste incineration on August the 31st after receiving the permit modification that I discussed with you last week. During the first 3 days of operation, it safely disposed of a total of 135 tons of waste. The water spray system worked very well in cooling the flue gases, and we achieved an average incineration rate of about 3 tons per hour, which was in the line of our expectations, so we've been happy with that. The unit was shut down on September the 3rd to make repairs to the conveyor system that transports waste into the incinerator. Although this was still functioning, the hydraulic cylinders on the conveyor were leaking and causing a potential environmental and safety hazard, and we felt it best to repair that. The cylinders have been rebuilt, and we're attempting to get them out to the barge this evening. The weather is not as good as it could be, and so there could be some delay. Assuming they can get there tonight, we expect to have them installed and have the incinerator back up and running tomorrow sometime. Our efforts to work off the Dayville Road stockpile are continuing, and we're currently down to about 10% of the oily solid waste stored there that we had about a month ago, so we're very happy with the progress on that. Now that we have the Sealy incinerator operational and the stockpile at Dayville dwindling, Chemical Waste Management has reduced the Anchorage repackaging facility to single shift operations and is planning to go to single shift at Seward either today or tomorrow. On the liquid side, the wash water treatment system at the Hanalei barge is now complete and operational. We're currently identifying vessels to transfer the treated wastewater to the City of Valdez sewage treatment plant. During the past week, we did begin disposal of treated wash waters from our Dayville Road pretreatment facility. As you may know, the oily wash water is the last of the major waste streams that we expect to deal with, and we're glad that we now have the system operational and the performance meeting the requirements so that we can begin disposal of that product. Are there any questions? I'd be glad to address them.
I have a question. Rob, has Exxon or its contractor sought approval from any of the land managers for alternative sites? Uganic, Terra Bay, Muscomee, Molina, Kazakov, or Discover?
Several of the alternative sites are in state waters, and so we understand that the state would be looking at those as part of the process. We have not requested approval from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for sites within the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. We discussed the possibility with the Fish and Wildlife Service with regard to permitting in there. Indications were that that would be a two-week-plus process, and we didn't feel like there was sufficient time remaining to embark upon that path.
Do you know what the date was that the village of Port Lyons first expressed its resistance to operating the AET incinerator in Bicota Bay?
I don't know the date offhand.
It's been more than 2 weeks, hasn't it?
It probably has.
I was very involved in that process since they first objected. I worked very closely with your people. As I understand it, the process at that time was to pursue getting a letter of non-objection from all concerned agencies and other parties for alternative sites, including Molina Bay. Each time that process was pursued, an objection arose and it was dropped. Since ADEC chose to pursue it that way and did not ask that time to apply for a permit for an alternative site, I assumed that I was receiving advice on how alternative sites would be pursued for Exxon by ADEC and for AET by ADEC. If the procedure has changed, we have not been made aware of that.
Well, Bill, the department indicated early on that we supported the local community if it had an objection and that Exxon needed to work to find another location. We've been happy to work with you to identify possible locations, and we've done everything we can to locate a place where you can operate the AET incinerator, but we just can't do your job for you. You've got to seek the approval of the appropriate landowner.
Or can we do your job for you, sir, and you're the one that did not issue the permit properly?
Well, let me point out that the issue here is whether the local community gets to exercise its authority under state and federal law.
Yes, and was there a public hearing there, sir?
In order to make sure that the community does, we've suspended the permit so they can make the determination under the state and federal law. But the point is that the other locations which do not have the objection of the local community have simply not been pursued by Exxon or its contractor. I think it comes down to that. Now, you need to do something about that if you're going to get off the dime on this and make some progress in finding an alternative site. It's not the state's job to find that for you. You have to deal with the local landowners.
I understand your tactics to make your problem my problem, but I won't allow it.
Well, I'm sorry, but the problem is in your lap no matter whether you want to allow it or not. I just want to make the point that the ball is in your court. If you're going to find a location that doesn't have an objection from the local village, you need to get moving on it.
When the ball was in both of our courts and we were working cooperatively, I worked very closely with Steve and with Ray Morris. We pursued every site that between us we could think of might be a possibility. I got with Ray. Ray told me, I give up. We do not know of any further sites that are available for this incinerator, nor do we think that there is time remaining under the permit process that is required to pursue an alternative site before the incinerator must leave for safety reasons. We believe our only viable option is either to start it up in the current site, if that's allowed, or to not start it up at all this summer.
So what you're basically saying, though, Bill, and this is the reason that we think this is such a problem, is that you're prepared to roll the local community, or that you want to, and operate the incinerator over the objection. That's not a very wise way to proceed here, and that's why we think the alternatives would be worth exploring. We're happy to keep assisting in doing that, but you're the ones that have to make the application. We can't do that for you.
My understanding, Mr. Kelso, is the reason that you had the public hearings at Kodiak, which were not required by law, was to make sure that all of the communities there had a chance to have their say and have discussions. And the meetings that followed that, where ADEC participated in the process of trying to select a site that was not objected to by anyone in Kodiak, I believe that the current site was selected and the ADEC representative participated in that process, as did the mayor of the borough of Kodiak. Unfortunately, after that, the village of Port Lyons indicated that they were not properly involved in that process and they had an objection. I believe that we, Exxon, and ADEC worked very closely together to try to accommodate the village of Port Lyons' concerns and to find a proper alternative site that was acceptable to all, and that all those alternatives have been exhausted to the best of my knowledge.
but you've got to make a move on it.
If we made a move on it, how soon do you think we might obtain a permit for a new location?
If the move had been made at the time that the objection came, you'd have it now, but...
And if you had applied for the permit properly, we'd be able to start up where we are now.
Well, the point is you'd still be trying to roll the local community, and that's what we're objecting to.
No, sir, we are not trying to roll over a community. I'm sure ADEC would not have issued the permit if they thought there was any reason not to issue the permit, including any threat to the village of Port Lyons.
Well, let's pursue it. Let's get together after this meeting and see what kind of list we can put together. We've already got a list, and let's see which ones are most look likely to be most productive.
I'd like to do that.
Okay, that's fine. Let's try to do that and move on to another subject, because
yes,
we won't solve it here.
Any other questions in that area? The remainder of our written report here, Admiral, is detailed skimmer and boom deployment status. I don't plan to cover that. I would like to introduce Henry Hubble, who will cover the current status of our vessel transition.
Good evening. My name is Henry Hubble. I'm working in our transition logistics group, and I'm going to give you a brief rundown on the transition activities that have occurred over the past week. Weather continues to play an important role, as I covered last week, in our transition activities. Many of the vessels, and that impacts our transition activities because many of the vessels, unless the weather conditions are quite mild, cannot move from their operating positions in the Sound through boat washing facilities and into safe home harbors to be stripped and then ready for their ultimate transit to Gulf of Alaska or wherever their home port is. During this last week, we've had a few narrow weather windows where we have been able to move boats. That required a lot of pre-planning and close coordination to make sure that those vessels were able to move when those good weather windows occurred. I am pleased to report that our progress is continuing to be very close to our plan, and this past week's activities have concentrated on those phase two vessels that I mentioned last week, and these are the vessels that have weather critical transit dates in the 9-1 to 9-14 kind of time frame. This last week's activities have focused on those vessels that needed to leave in the very late and very early August time frame. At all of the vessels in this phase two group, total about 34 vessels, and about 14 of them in this September 1st time frame. The vessels in this with the earliest departure dates in the 9-1 time frame have at this point been released from operations. They have been processed through vessel washing and have been prepared for transit through the Gulf of Alaska if that was required and are underway. So things are moving along. We have 29 of those critical vessels that have moved out to date. We continue to wind down our support vessels and personnel in parallel with these that were involved with the support of these critical vessels, the critical weather window vessels that we had out there. And as Bill mentioned earlier, we now stand at 1,100 vessels, down about 90 from the previous week, personnel at 9,200. Down about 700 from the previous week. At the same time, we're winding down the vessels, we're recovering assets and preparing those for shipment to our winter storage location in Anchorage. And to date, there are over 300 shipments that have been made out of the port areas into Anchorage for winterization and winter storage. In summary, the activities are continuing on schedule. We're going to be continuing this next week with our phase two program. And that'll be moving the vessels out or preparing those for transit that need to get out of here in the 9-7 through 9-14 time frame. Be glad to answer any questions that anyone has.
Thank you, Henry.
Okay, thank you.
Admiral, our last topic, I'd like to introduce Mike Barker. Mike is a biologist with Exxon and will discuss bird retrieval and rehabilitation.
I think most people here are probably aware that the bird mortality rates have gone up slightly here in the last few weeks in the Kodiak Island area, and I've been taking a look at it, and rather than offer solutions to it, I'd like to offer some observations that I've made on what's going on down there. Most of the mortalities that are being reported now are coming from three areas, and those are K1, K7, and K11. K1 is the north end of Kodiak, on the north end of the Fog Neck. K7 is on the south end of Kodiak, particularly Tagetik Island, western of the two Trinity Islands, and then Chignik Bay, right on the peninsula past what's shown on the map there. I've recently come back from that area, spent the better part of a day on Tagetik Island, and we were hoping that we would be able to collect some fairly fresh carcasses and then do necropsy work, tissue analyses, and hopefully determine cause of death on these birds. We found that the majority of the carcasses were not fresh nor suitable for necropsy or autopsy. Of the 65 carcasses that Bob Mastracchio and I and Paul Burke from the Fish and Wildlife Service looked at that day, we only found two that we felt like that we could do necropsy work on. Neither of those were of the species that seems to be of concern now, which is the short-tailed shearwater. The two birds that we picked up were a horned puffin and a black-legged kittiwake. The majority of the birds continue to be, during the last several weeks, unoiled. The bird rescue center in Seward that's being run by the International Bird Rescue Research Foundation's reporting 85% of the birds show no indications of exterior oiling. It seems like that most people right now want to blame the spill on any reported mortalities, and there are two things that are inevitable in life. I've learned that taxes and death are those two things, and birds don't pay taxes, but they do die of natural causes. And I suggest that many of the birds that are washing up right now are dying of natural causes. And speaking with some of the biologists with Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage today, I've learned that several oceanographers are reporting that water temperatures in the North Pacific are running colder than usual in the upper regime of the ocean, and that's forcing the fish prey species down to lower depths, making them less accessible to birds like short-tailed shearwaters that live literally hundreds of miles offshore and depend on these smaller prey fish species such as capelin. If the fish are driven deeper into the water profile, then they're inaccessible to these birds and they die of starvation. It's been pointed out to me very clearly by Jan White, the veterinarian there at the Seward Center, that all of the birds that are coming in now are emaciated and anemic, signs of starvation. And again, it ties in with the current theory that I've heard from the Fish and Wildlife Service. When seabirds die in large numbers, those are referred to as wrecks. And wrecks of black-legged kittiwakes and short-tailed shearwaters have been documented very, very numerous times over the years. Probably one of the more famous ones was when El Nino came in, I believe, in 1985 or 1986, and clearly hundreds of thousands of birds were reported to have died as a result of that and washed up on Alaskan shores. We had hoped to, when we got down to Tagetik, to actually collect some carcasses and submit them for pathologic and toxicologic analyses. We've been unable to receive any of those samples. It requires permits, which we've currently been unable to obtain, and the Fish and Wildlife Service has not made those samples available. They have submitted samples. Some of them are here at the Coast Guard Mobile Lab. The only results that I'm privy to at this current time came off of one bird off of Kodiak Island that was not exteriorly oiled. It was reported that it had a very dark semi-viscous fluid in its stomach that was analyzed by the lab, and it was negative for crude oil. We've actually received no analyses, though, from Fish and Wildlife Service at this point. While I was on Tagetik Island, I saw no evidence of oil on the beaches that I visited. Bob and I and Paul Burke met with the two residents there on the island. Mrs. Garber was very gracious and met with us for quite a while. She also indicated that the birds that she's finding, the very large majority, are showing no signs of exterior oil. And we talked to the people that are responsible for picking up those carcasses off of Tegedik. They reported again that the majority of the birds were unoiled, and in fact the birds that they'd picked up that day, they got no oil on their hands from retrieving them. The lagoon there on Tegedik, which is of some concern because emperor geese spent some time there during fall migration, there was no signs of oil in the lagoon, nor during all of these efforts to retrieve bird carcasses had they ever retrieved a carcass in the lagoon itself, yet they had visited it several times. And I think we've made a really good faith effort here to try and collect carcasses. When they were exteriorly oiled, we were removing the carcasses so that they wouldn't enter the food chain and be scavenged by bears and bald eagles. We're clearly seeing now that the carcasses are not exteriorly oiled. Cause of death is uncertain. And I would like for people to consider the fact that natural causes could certainly be at play here. I think probably a more logical explanation for many of the more recently reported deaths. We're seeing young seabirds coming off of the colonies and trying to negotiate open water for some of the first days of their life. And we see that after storms, the carcass counts go up. And that's basically, I guess, all I really had. I would like to say that what I've seen out there was a lot more encouraging than what I thought I would see before I initially came up to Alaska a couple of months ago. I see no species that's endangered by the effects of this spill. I see a good representation of all of the species that I expected to see here, and in plentiful numbers. Food supplies generally seem to be unaffected, and I think that we're going to probably see some real bumper crops next year, if for no other reason than the fact that the escapement on salmon is much higher than normal this year, and there should be plenty of food for lots of the animals to feed on. Reasons for why we're pulling back on bird rescue boats are not economic in nature. Those plans are based on concerns for personnel safety and the fact that we're not seeing wild carcasses on the beach, which need to continue to be picked up. And I'd like to point out to everybody that sometimes we underestimate the power of Mother Nature. We're dealing with a force there that can probably do a much better job of replenishing populations and returning the environment back to good condition than any of us would like to think we're empowered with. That's that.
Questions? Yeah, if I might comment here, I guess there is some other information concerning the bird kills in the Kodiak area, and we have some information that was presented, or it comes from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regional director there, Walter Stieglitz, and he indicated that there are necropsies on several of the birds did indicate oil ingestion. He also indicated that there were an unusually high number of dead birds being processed at the morgue, and that they were fresh dead specimens, which was quite disconcerting to them. Also, they said also that there were no visible signs of external oiling on any of the specimens, but they said there were some internal disorders and that petroleum toxicity may be involved. There are tests that are being run now to try and confirm what the birds did die of, but it certainly hasn't been ruled out that petroleum toxicity may be the cause of death from some it entering into the food chain and through some mechanism.
Yeah, I guess my thought about that is if they're dying from the oil, I'd like to know where it's coming from. That's the problem that I have at this late date to get this kind of a bird kill. Is from the oil is illogical to me, and I can't. Somebody with a lot more smarts than I are going to have to figure that out, I think.
I would like to point out that a necropsy is probably not capable of determining the cause of death of a bird if oil is involved, and it would require pretty extensive pathologic and histologic work on the tissues and the blood and so forth. I understand what the gentleman in front of me here is saying, and in Mr. Stieglitz's letter, he indicates that there were indications of oil. And that was based on the stomach contents of these four storm petrels that were looked at by Dr. John Pletcher from the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. He suspected that it tested positive for occult blood. Petrels are known to contain the substance in their stomach. It's what they feed their young. They feed out at sea many miles away from the colonies, and then they return and regurgitate that to their young. He indicated that it was Oelian nature. The word petrel, the name of the bird, is indicative of the petroleum-based or the petroleum-like substance that they carry in their digestive tract that they regurgitate for the young. That sample did, in fact, test negative for crude oil here at the Coast Guard Marine Lab or Mobile Lab. That is the only sample that I know of that's been tested that came from an unoiled bird. And we have asked for reports. I have a two-paragraph report from Dr. John Pletcher, and that's all we have available to us at this time.
I had a question. We're talking about a substantial number of birds here, are we not?
They're coming in somewhere on the order of, well, almost all of the birds are coming from three areas I indicated, and they're being reported at levels of 1,200 to 1,600 a week right now, somewhere in that area.
So a total of several thousand, many thousands of these?
Well, since March 24th, mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, my observation would be that this is a, I'm not trying just to pin this mortality on the spill. I guess I'd be more interested in pinning my taxes to it. But since I can't do that, it seems to me that we ought to be able to bring the right experts together to unravel this particular mystery. Is there anybody from the service here tonight?
Yeah,
that could speak to it?
Here.
I don't want to put anyone on the spot if they're not ready to speak to it, but if you are, it might be helpful. While you're coming up, while you're coming up, it seems to me that when you have an event, a bird kill of this magnitude, whatever the cause, it's appropriate to try to find out what the source is. I don't think we should assume that necessarily the same mechanism is operating as was operating in the early days of the spill. Clearly, we're not talking about a hypothermia problem here. And we're not likely talking about the acute toxicity from light end fractions of the oil, I would assume, Dave, that. But there may be other toxic effects associated with the oil or with the oil water emulsion or whatever. And rather than try to pin it on any particular cause here, it seems to me that we just need to make sure that we bring the right experts together to unravel it.
That's a good point. It's kind of coming late in the game right now, and we probably should have started looking at some of these tissue samples and the blood samples that came in on Shearwaters back in early July. I would like to point out that I'm not trying to set up some sort of confrontation with the Fish and Wildlife Service, just the opposite. We found the majority of the Fish and Wildlife Service people extremely cooperative. They want the answer to this question as much as we do. And they don't want to find that birds are dying from oil any more than we do, and so I'd like to just say that before Dick talks.
My name is Dick Wadoski. I'm with the Fish and Wildlife Service on detail here from Denver. Been here about 2 weeks, so I'm kind of new to this game. However, we have taken these samples of birds. The stomach contents that was taken out was black in nature, as Mike indicated. We don't know exactly what it was, except that the NOAA lab has looked at it, and a couple turned out to be oil, and it turned out to be fingerprinted to Prudhoe Bay oil. These birds do die from natural causes on occasion too, so we know that's occurring. I think what you just said a moment ago here, that we really do need to take a look at the entire thing to find out what's going on here. There's an exceptional number of birds dying out there right now. No oil on the outside, but inside it looks like there's hemorrhaging going on. That's indicative of hydrocarbon poisoning. Again, we don't want to cast stones. I think what we need to do is take a look at what we're finding out there, look at it closely, and determine what the cause of death is. Is it natural? Is it caused by the spill itself?
I have one thing to add to all of this. As I understand it, NOAA has analyzed one sample that in fact was positive, and the oil was typed as Exxon Valdez oil. Probably the unfortunate part of that is that along with the Exxon Valdez oil, we also found another very light hydrocarbon product with it. Very, very puzzling. And as a result of that, we have asked for other samples, and I believe we've received 5 other samples, which I don't have the results of yet. But most definitely, we need to put our heads together. And the preliminary result that we found that was typed with Exxon Valdez and this other hydrocarbon product, which was a much lighter, it was much lighter in nature, certainly just adds to the confusion.
There is a lot of confusion. We need to get at the root of it.
Yeah, I think we do too, and I think some work needs to be done, and I think we will do it. Let's move on to the next. Thank you.
Admiral, that concludes Exxon's report.
Okay. ADEC.
Okay. Thank you, Admiral. In our current issues and developments today, we are continuing to work with Exxon and the Coast Guard with regard to the use of Interpol. We did issue a notice of violation over the weekend for the misuse of the Interpol, and I think we've got that worked out, and everything seems to be going along smoothly now. Also, we have been...
Yeah, I appreciate everybody's working together to work out the problems with the application, and I think that is the way things ought to work. A lot of cooperation to get the job done.
We also have been in contact with the village residents of Chiniga Bay, who live near the Sawmill Bay Fish Hatchery, and they are interested in pursuing winter cleanup activities, such as debris removal, and also feel that they could provide assistance in protection of the fish hatchery during the winter months from any oil that may float down that direction that's released off of some of the islands, or could be released off some of the islands this winter. They also have a lot of experience in working in Alaska, and feel that they could work safely out there and conduct these types of activities. Also, on Kodiak Island, the native villagers there have been invited to participate in a winter operations planning session in Kodiak, and that's going to take place this evening, I guess. With regard to the AET incinerator, which I think plenty has been said already, but the public hearing on that will be held tomorrow evening in Kodiak. Also, we have a handout today that was handed out separately, I guess, from our report, but I'm going to ask Marshall Kinsorek if he'll come up and explain it and let you know where we are with regard to our analysis of the miles treated and so on.
Yeah. My name is Marshall Kinsorek. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm the data manager for the department. We've been working in conjunction with the Coast Guard, NOAA, and some with the Exxon data, trying to move that into some of the database work that we've been doing to combine a lot of the mileage information we have on the various coastlines, the treatment information that's in some of the Exxon database work, and the Coast Guard's Cameo system. We've been moving that data around, sharing it quite readily. And we're looking at it in somewhat different ways, but we're looking at the same information. And we handed out a little, just cranked it out about 6 o'clock this evening, just a little pie chart that is trying to put across where things stand right about now in the treatment that's going on. This is so far just for Prince William Sound. We're working up the Kenai Peninsula and Kodiak and hope to have that fully analyzed in the next couple days. One thing you can see is immediately that the biggest chunk, over 56%, has been treated and demobilized. It's worth noting that that is the phase one treatment, which means just the gross contamination has been removed. In addition, the next biggest chunk, or in this case two chunks, are the areas that were not recommended for treatment. Some of those have been signed off, some haven't. That's in some ways part of a paperwork shuffle, but all those are areas that were not recommended for various reasons, be they bird rookeries impossible to get to for logistical reasons like cliff face, something like that, various reasons, archaeological reasons. Some of the areas are in areas where there's archaeological remains, so they don't want to go and work on them. The areas, there's a little tiny slice of the pie, if you will, where we're saying the treatment is incomplete. Those represent areas where they went in to do some work and they were asked to pull out because the seals were coming back or various reasons, so they had to pull away from those areas to stop working on them. They then, in some of those cases, are then going back to go work on them after the seals have pupped or what have you. That leaves the remaining 14%, which has not been approved for demobilization by the Coast Guard. This is data which is based on yesterday's database from the Coast Guard. We have not gotten today's information yet, so we'll be having that tomorrow. We try to keep as up to date as we can, but the stuff can only flow so quickly between us. We are also, the state is also busy evaluating areas, and there is relatively few, very few I would say, areas where we do not concur. Only five, I believe, segments in all of Prince William Sound out of 500 and some odd segments where we do not concur at all with it being demobilized, which is fairly good, but they're still out there. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
I'd like to comment that it is pleasing to see that Exxon's statement on miles remaining were 3.5 miles out of the 350 miles or so in Prince William Sound that were initially impacted by the oil. That seems to agree very well with treatment incomplete on 1%.
Actually, the treatment incomplete is the area that represents the area that they had to pull out from. The area that where we are saying it has not been signed off yet, has not been demobilized, is the 14%.
I was just making a comment.
Well, I think these, we've worked together to get these numbers about right. Some of us use different numbers for different reasons, but I think when we take out the differences, those differences, we come up with pretty close to being the same numbers, and that's good. I never thought we'd get this close when we're talking about some 3,000, 2,500 miles that were scattered altogether. To come out that close is phenomenal.
I have one more topic I'd like to mention. With regard to the Corexit test this last Sunday, I guess our observations are somewhat different than Exxon's in that we didn't feel that there was a good recovery of oil from the Corexit. Also, we saw a pretty significant plume leaving the primary boom area. Also, along the shoreline, it was also getting outside the secondary boom. So again, we observed that it really wasn't effective, and they were having a hard time containing it. I wasn't there. In fact, I was in Anchorage having some dental work done, but we had plenty of observers that were there.
I was there, oversaw it from the air. I didn't see what you just described. Admiral Robbins, you were there.
I looked at it at about 2:30, and the plume was well defined. It was inside the primary boom. Apparently the currents were not taking it along the beach. It was very well defined, as I've said. Later, the Scott commander, my person on scene, looked at it, and the wind effect and the current had taken some toll on it and had moved some of it outside of the secondary boom along the shore. My feeling is that the plume actually is beneath the surface, that it, and when we talk about the plume, we're talking about this discoloration that occurs in the water, and frankly, I haven't heard anything well defined as to what causes that, whether it's just a turbidity or something else, I'm not sure. But the upshot of it was that as the wind and current took effect, it did in fact take it under the boom.
Whether that means anything or is important or not is not clear to me because I don't know what's in the plume.
Admiral, when we did the test at Disk Island back at the end of July, there was a brown plume that came off the beach, and it really was connected more with the type of sediment off that particular type of beach. And in fact, overflying some other areas are being hot water washed, you could see a similar brown plume. The character of the sediments is different in different parts of the sound. When we took the TPH measurements, or total petroleum hydrocarbon measurements, they turned out to be quite low, even though the plume looked dirty, quote unquote. And I think you'll find the same thing when you take measurements on this plume too.
All reports that we've had so far on what limited samples were taken, I would agree that there wasn't it wasn't there.
One last comment, Steve, in response to what you discussed.